Accession number 31448, Mr. Roy Jones, Reel 3. Now, where did you go in May 44 then? Where were you told to report to?
I was told to report to Stranraer, a place I'd never heard of in my life, didn't even know where it was. And I said to my dad, where's Stranraer? He said, it's up in Scotland. So I get the train from Lime Street Station. And bear in mind, I wasn't even 18. And I met another chap on Lime Street Station that was going to Stranraer. It was a transit camp. And I was there in my suit and my little case. Got on the train. And in them days, the trains, the toilets were very, very few and far between, unless you were lucky enough to get on a coach that had a corridor that run the length of the coach, and they had toilets on. Otherwise, it was a bottle job and out the window. But I hate to say it, but that was the truth, because there was no toilets on the trains. You were in a compartment that sat about eight people, and the door on one side, door on the other side, and then fresh air. So what I'm saying is, there were trains that had a corridor the length of the coach, and they had toilets on. But if you were stuck in one with no toilet, and you were going, say, from Liverpool to Stranraer, the only thing you could do was jump out at a railway station if you knew where the toilet was and be back in time before the train left. So that was that. Anyway, we get to Stranraer, and there was an army sergeant there. And he got us all together, and we got in this three-ton truck. And he took us to this transit camp. I've never seen such a hole in all my life. We went, and we were given... We get out the truck, and they issued us with no mattress, just a couple of blankets. And he said, right, follow me. And we followed him, and we went into these Nissen huts. And there was beds in there. There was no heat. There was beds in there. No mattresses. No pillows. And he just said to us, pick a bed. Breakfast is at 0700 in the morning.
So you've got no uniform?
Not there, no. Breakfast is at 7 o'clock in the morning. And just walked out and shut the door. So we just gets on the beds. I used my little case for a pillow and threw the blankets over us fully dressed. Gets up the next morning. We didn't know where to go for a wash or anything because nobody had shown us. And in comes this sergeant. He said, your ablutions are up there. And we looked up and there's a bit of a hill. And all there was on the top of this hill was a trough with a wooden frame, a frame either side, and then a piece of wood running along the top, and a tap here and there. So it was cold water. You had to take your own mirror, if you were lucky enough to have carried one, to get a wash and a shave. Then they fell us in, and we marched about half a mile to get a breakfast. And the breakfast, from what I can remember, it wasn't that bad. It wasn't good, but it wasn't that bad. And then we were taken down to the ferry at Stranraer. And we got on the boat to Larne in Northern Ireland. And from Larne, we got the train to a little place called Kinnegar Holt.
Do you know how you spell it? Or is that going to be the camp you stay at?
No. Okay. Kinnegar Holt, I think it was K-I-N-N. Right. We got off the train at a place called Kinnegar Holt. And we were met by some three-ton wagons. We boarded the wagons, and then we were taken to Palace Barracks in Holywood, Northern Ireland.
Hollywood.
Hollywood, as Hollywood.
And is that just a town?
Yes, it's only a little village, Palace Barracks in Hollywood. In fact, I think the barracks are still there.
Now, so what was your reception like when you got there?
It was fine, it was all right. There's nothing wrong with the reception there.
How did they treat you? I mean, friendly or a bit of left, right, left, you know?
I think everybody who went to Palace Barracks in Northern Ireland were volunteers. I think the conscripts went to another part of Ireland somewhere.
Now, who was it training you? I mean, was this actually the Royal Welsh Fusiliers or was it...
No, it was... What you're enlisted in, first of all, for the first 6 months was what they called the General Service Corps, GSC, you wore on your thing. As a joke, they used to call us General Smuts's Commando. As a joke. But that was the... It was... I forget what the cap badge was like now. It's just like a coat of arms, something like that sort of thing it was. The cap
so this was just an infantry training centre?
Yes, just an infantry training centre. We went there and we were issued with our kit.
Now, what do you remember of what kit you got? As much detail as you manage.
Kit, as far as I can remember now, was two khaki battle dresses, two pair of boots, underwear, two khaki shirts, like flannelette stuff. A khaki pullover. A beret. A greatcoat. Socks. A housewife. That was like a white thing that you kept. Needles and cottons and all that sort of stuff. Your knife, fork and spoon went in that as well. A mug, two plates. A mattress, two blankets and a pillow. I think that was it.
Now, did your kit fit you? How are your uniform, right?
Yeah, but mine fitted me all right. I don't know whether I was stock size, but mine seemed to fit me all right. But other fellas that were a bit smaller than me, they looked big on them, you know, because they never altered uniforms in the army. And fellas that were taller, the sleeves would be a bit shorter. You know, it was that sort of thing. But your boots, if it was size 8, size 8, and that was it, your socks, just given to you. And then you were taken and shown a billet, and we were in huts. We weren't in the actual barracks.
Now, could you describe these huts as much detail as you can?
Well, all the hut was, it wasn't the Nissen hut, it wasn't the old Nissen hut. These were a brick-built hut with one round stove in the middle of the room with the chimney that used to go up and through the roof, and that was the only source of heating. The ablution blocks were separate from the hut. In other words, within the hut, you didn't have capabilities of washing, showering, or a shave. The ablution block was separate. That was undercover. The dining rooms were further down towards the main barrack block. And the guard room was at the main entrance, and next to the guard room there was like a canteen you used to call Aggie Weston's, and I could recommend the beans on toast in there, sausage, egg and beans as well in there. It was very, very good, actually. Very good. The food, Northern Ireland, was good. Wasn't bad at all.
Now, in what way? I mean, what, was there enough of it?
Well, there were, well, you got enough to suffice, but if I think if you were a big eater, you were left a little bit hungry. But then if you had a couple of bob in your pocket, you could go down to Aggie Weston's and get yourself something, which wasn't that dear in them days. I forget now how much you'd probably get beans on toast for threepence or fourpence, something like that. You know, it wasn't very dear.
Was the food reasonably prepared? And
yeah, in Northern Ireland, I've got to be honest and say, yes, it was. The training...
Now, we look at a typical day's training, because that sort of takes us through most of the things. So how would your day start?
Right, Revalley was 6 o'clock.
So what do you do? Revalley goes, what happens?
Revalley, up, wash, shave, make your bed up. Breakfast was around about 7 o'clock. First parade, 8 o'clock.
Now tell me about drill. I mean, there's various things you can do.
Oh, well.
How did you take to drill?
I don't know what it was with me. I just seemed to fall in with it. It never was a chore to me. It never was difficult to me. Although we had some people who didn't know the left from the right, which is hard to visualise, but it's true. And when I first went in the service, one little trick of mine was, whenever they said, the squad will move to the left, I just used to move a finger on my left hand. Keep that right one still, move a finger on my left hand, I know where I was, you know. And I still do that today. It's just a habit that I've got into, that if it's right, I just move a finger on my right hand, and I know then, and I don't think you can go wrong in that way. So the drill was never hard or difficult for me.
Did you enjoy it? Because some people do, really.
Yes. Drill has never, ever bothered me. And
Why did you like it?
I don't know, really. You've got me over a barrel here, because I've never, ever given that any thought as to why I like drill. And I'll expand on this later on when I come to my time with the Royal Marines. I just liked it. And I suppose it's difficult for some people to understand why I'm sat here now telling you that I like drill, where probably another chap or any other person that's been in the service would probably think to themselves, something wrong with that lad there. But I honestly did like drill. And I couldn't give you the reason why.
Did you understand then the point of it? Because there is a point to it.
I, not right away, but after probably about a month, drill for me is all about discipline. It's a means to an end. And if you've got a crowd of men and the discipline is instilled into them, then I feel you've got the respect of those men. And that's all it is with any training, I feel, no matter where you are in life. Especially in the service. They push, push, push. And all it is to see how far you can go or you can put up with as a person. And that, to me, it just instills all the discipline. And that never, ever seems to leave you. Once you've got that, I feel you've got that for the rest of your life then. And that's where, in my eyes, you learn to respect people, which is, it's sort of a, like a round robin now. You come back to the present day, there's no discipline anywhere these days.
Now, so you lots of drill. What about physical training? We'll come on to weapons training after.
Well,
but what about
physical training? We used to do that every day, and you started early on in the gym, and you'd do beams, a horse, ropes, and they didn't push you too far too soon. The rope work was learn how to climb a rope probably 20 foot and reach the beam at the top, and then not slide down but come down under control. The beam was used for pulling yourself up to chest level, and all it was all about was upper body strength, really, to develop your upper body for obvious reasons. Against the wall, the bars at the wall where you put your feet under, and you do sit-ups there. That was only to strengthen your legs and your stomach muscles, and that was a bit of a bind at times. I wouldn't go as far as to say that I enjoyed that by any stretch of the imagination.
And what about moving out of the gym and into other PT?
Well,
you know?
Then the other side of the PT was to take it out doing exercises with a log, just normal physical training work like stretching your arms, stretching your legs, running on the spot, and that sort of thing. And all it was, I think anyway, was to develop probably muscles that you never ever used before in your life, and to give you the upper body strength that you'll need later on in your training.
What about sort of moving on to route marches and cross-country runs?
Well, we didn't do much cross-country runs. It was on the running side, it was what they used to call forced marches, where you do a forced march where you run 100 yards, walk 100 yards, and I could go on for 5 miles. You know, run 100, walk 100, run 100, walk 100, all the time, and do that for 5 miles. That's what they used to call a speed marching. But on normal route marches, was you'd start at a very a low one of 6 miles, and that's what this lot went to. We developed from 6, 9, 10, 14, 15, 17, 24, 25. Then these others in between that come now from 25 back to 10, they were speed marches, 10, 10. And the last route march in training here in Northern Ireland was 44-mile route march.
Now that's a hell of a lot.
Well, altogether here, if you go, I don't know how many miles marched here, 18 route marches in 6 months. And
do you think it all made you fitter? I mean, I don't know how fit you were when you went in, though, you know.
Well, I wasn't as fit when I went in as I was when I came out. I'll put it that way.
I forgot to mention sport. Had you done much sport before you went in?
Very little. Played football for school. Cricket, but that was about it.
And that was a fair number of years before.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And then, you know, during your route marches, you had all your other stuff to do, like learning to fire a rifle.
I will come to it. What about, did you have, last thing in PT, did you have boxing or milling?
Well, the milling came in later. Yeah, we had milling where you stood toe to toe and knock seven bells out of each other for 3 minutes. It was only 3 minutes and that was it. But you've done that.
That's where there's not really any defence, isn't there?
No, you just have boxing gloves on. And you just stand and you just belt one another for 3 minutes. And if a fella goes down, then you used to stop. That was it.
And what do you think of that?
It's quite good fun. Good fun. Unless you got in with a big fella. But I was fortunate enough. I'm of average height and build. And it, you know, it sort of was okay.
What about assault courses? Did you have them?
Yes.
What was it like?
The assault course in the army, from what I can remember, the one in Palace Barracks, wasn't that bad, actually. It consisted of climbing a rope, running over logs, suspended over water, scaling a wall.
Were you allowed to help each other? Or was it
No.
It was a one-man thing?
Yeah. No, you didn't help one another. The only time you touched another chap was when you did what they call a fireman's lift. That was if a fella got wounded and you had to sling him across your shoulders. And one of the tests was probably carrying him 100 to 200 yards after you'd been over the assault course. So you were on your uppers when you finished the assault course, and then you had to pick the fella up and what's her name. Which, as I say again, in the army wasn't too bad. Wasn't as bad as I was confronted with later on in my service career.
Now take us through weapons training, and how did they start you with weapons training?
Well, they issued you with your rifle, and it was all covered in grease. It was straight from the manufacturers, because you were issued with a brand new rifle.
That's a Lee Enfield.
Yeah, 303. So that all had to be cleaned, and the idea of cleaning that, we used to burn the grease off, because you couldn't get it off any other way. Burn the grease off, now, get it all clean. That was that. Then they used to, before you did any firing or anything like that, you did arms drill with your rifle, and they learnt you how to spring to attention with the rifle, slope arms, present arms, order arms, and that was about it in the army. That. And then they took you down on the range, and funny enough, I was left-handed, and I had to learn to fire the rifle from my right hand, which I did.
Was that a big problem?
I must be what do you call it when you do it? What's the word? Is it ambidextrous?
Ambidextrous.
Something. That. Because that didn't bother me. And I think one of the reasons why was, is because I throw with my left hand and I write with my right hand. If I do anything with a shovel, it's left-handed. So, learning to go from that, left-handed, and the trouble was, with it being left-handed, the bolt was on the right-hand side. So, it was absolutely stupid, you couldn't do it. So they taught me how to fire right-handed, and it came all right. Having never handled a rifle before, it wasn't that much of a problem, because I was learning something new. So it didn't come as much of a problem. So I learned to fire right-handed. And I think you were learning on a rifle, a light machine gun, LMGs, a Sten gun, and a Tommy gun.
Hang on, tell us a bit more about the rifle training. So how did it progress? How did they actually teach you to fire it?
They took you down on the range, and you got down in what they call a prone position, lying down, with the instructor by you, telling you to put the butt of the rifle in onto your shoulder there. Make sure it's onto the shoulder, into the shoulder, not up on the bone, but into the shoulder. And you rest your elbows. Then you pull the rifle in with that hand.
With your left hand?
With your left hand into your shoulder. And the trigger's got two pressures. The first pressure, it stops. Then the next one, you pull, you fire the round. It was a bit daunting the first time. I don't care who you are, and as much as they tell you to really pull the rifle back and all that, you do pull the rifle back, but then they say to you that when you're going to press the trigger to fire, exhale and hold your breath to sight and then pull the trigger. So you forget about pulling this way because you're remembering to exhale and get the sight. And your first couple, bang, it hurts. But it's like everything else. Once you've done this a few times, you're fine. It's no problem at all. And as I said before, there's some people take to it all right and they can hit the target. Others are there for, and they would never hit anything because they're that far off the target. It's absolutely incredible with some people. But eventually they get there, but they're obviously not as good at it as some people that take to it.
Now, where were you in this?
You know, I was okay. I got a marksman there.
And, now, that's very good.
I was okay.
Now, what do you think made you a good shot? Is it eyesight? Is it breathing?
I think probably eyesight and coordination, probably. You see, when I first started, I fired here in the book here I've got. That my first rifle shot was on the 8th month. That was 2 months after I joined, and it was a second class shot. And by October,
is that when you finished?
Yeah, I was a first class shot, and I was lucky in a way that I qualified in every weapon we fired.
Now, tell me about bayonet training.
Bayonet training was, funny enough, we got a bayonet upstairs. I always found the bayonet training, I used to think to myself, are they going a bit overboard here?
What with?
With the bayonet training.
But in what way? What was it about it that was overboard?
Well, I used to think to myself, I wonder if we'll ever get into the situation where I'm that close to somebody that I've got to use a bayonet. And could I stick one in somebody? And I don't think anybody that's being truthful could really give you the answer to that until they were faced with the problem. All right, it's all right running down a field with sacks full of straw and showing you how to stick the bayonet in and withdraw, twist and withdraw the bayonet, and then go on to something else.
Were you shouting encouragement?
Oh yeah, you're shouting, you scream when you, they used to encourage us to scream when you stuck the bayonet in, and I suppose there again, if you're doing it for real, you probably would scream. I couldn't imagine anybody to keep their mouth shut if they're faced with that situation and they've got to ram a bayonet into somebody. I think you would scream, and I think part of that screaming is to take your mind off what you're about to do. That's my firm belief, that's what would happen.
Did they teach you bayonet fencing as well, which is, you know, bringing the butt through sort of
But the parry, yeah, where you taught you where the other fella would lunge a bayonet at you. And you padded the bayonet off and then brought the butt of your rifle alongside on the side of his face. You were taught that, yeah.
Did you actually practice that?
Not on somebody, not on another person, no. You practiced that on a dummy.
So it was only really the lunge and the parry, yeah. And the butt through. Yeah, that's about it.
That was about it, yeah.